Welcome to the Zoe Routh Leadership Podcast, your source of strategies and insights to make you a better leader. Influence, improve, inspire.
Hi, this is Zoe Routh, and I am delighted to interview Simon Dowling today on the podcast. And I have to confess, I know Simon already. He's a fellow thought leader in the business school, and he is just a wonderful bloke. I enjoy his company. Yeah. He is laid back. He's fun. He is just, I guess Australians would say fair dinkum. I'm not even sure that's appropriate use of the word, but and in any case, he's authentic and delightful to be around. So apart from my personal enthusiasm for Simon, he is professionally a collaboration specialist who works with senior teams to create environments where their people really thrive. He specializes in developing supercharged teams. I can't wait to hear what a supercharged team actually looks like. He is the author of this amazing book called Work With Me, How to Get People to Buy Into Your Ideas. And I love this book. It's one of the key things I hear from the people I work with all the time, too, is like, how do I get people to get on board? How do I influence? How do I manage up? How do I get them to come along for the ride on this change initiative? So this book answers a lot of that questions, and Simon's going to answer a few of them today, hopefully. Now, apart from being a guru and a nice guy, Simon has a really interesting background in that he started his professional career as a commercial lawyer, which I find terribly amusing, while also doing nighttime performances as an improv comedian. And he even appeared on the fabulous comedy here in Australia called Thank God You're Here. So welcome, Simon.
Wow. Thank you, Zoe. That surely is going to take the cake as the best introduction I've ever had.
Yay, I get a gold star. You're welcome. Well,
I was going to say, it's great to be here. And I think I'm glad that you take great pleasure out of my beginnings as a commercial lawyer, because I think at the time I'm not sure I saw the light side.
Well, I married a lawyer. I know there's not too many light sides, that's for sure. And you do need a highly developed sense of humor to navigate some of that territory. How long were you a lawyer?
Just under 6 years. It was about 5.5 years, I think.
Okay. So the biggest question I have is, how do you go from being a commercial lawyer in the big Sydney town and doing improv by night, moonlighting doing that, to doing what you're doing now as a collaboration specialist and working with senior teams and organizations? How does that happen?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's one of those pathways that if you were to be sitting in your final year at school and thinking, I'm going to design my career, it's probably not the one I would have designed, but it's the one I'm most blessed and thrilled to have followed. Because I think, you know, when I was a lawyer, I knew that that was not the long-term game for me, but it was just one of those things that I fell into in terms of my study, and ended up at uni studying both law, but also I was studying performing arts. So that's where the theatre bent came from, and I'd been interested in theatre for a long time before then, and that's how I fell into improv. Because being a lawyer, the thing with being a lawyer is that I found there was very little time for recreational activities outside of work. So if I wanted to keep theatre going, improv was the perfect thing, because it meant that I could do shows on, say, a Sunday night or a Thursday night, and there wasn't rehearsals required. So you rock up and you're making it all up on the spot. But for me, and in some respects, the improv piece has been a through line in everything I've done, because whereas being the context of the law firm I was working in, it was very much a sit in your cubicle or in your box and do your work in 6 minute intervals, and there was very little in terms of collaboration and interaction with others. At the same time, I'm performing in this improv group where it's all about working with others in a very ensemble way, and I often think of improv as the essence of great ensemble work. So I got hooked very early on, gosh, how do you get more of this teamwork, spontaneous collaboration? How do you get more of that going on in the context of the workplace, and why isn't that happening? So that's how I got really interested in that. And the first opportunity I had to really explore that was when, once I'd made the decision to leave the law, it was a question of where do I go next? And I was actually going to become a secondary school teacher at one stage, but I had the opportunity to go and work with a company that was consulting and training people in influencing skills and conflict resolution skills and so on. And my legal background made me the perfect candidate for them. But that's really the stepping stone I took. And before I knew it, I was working with a wide range of audiences, including lawyers.
I was going to ask, did you end up working with any legal firms around this?
Yeah, totally. And teaching law students at Monash Uni, which is where I'd studied law as well. And we were focused on the skills of how to manage conflict and to negotiate in a way that was far more collaborative than I think my own mindset as a lawyer had always been. So that's where the shift really started to happen. And I was in that context for about, well, over a decade, almost 12 years. And that was when I started to get really fascinated in the whole notion of how do we create truly collaborative workplaces, do that through leadership, how do we create a collaborative style of leadership? And that just grew on me like a bug. And so about five and a half, six years ago, I started my own practice in that area. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yay! And the fanfare happens. So I'm curious about one of the things you just said there, a collaborative style of leadership. So tell me a little bit more about what that looks like from your point of view.
Look, I think there is obviously a very traditional version of or model of leadership and management. And a lot of us grow up with that as a pretty clear archetype in our minds. And that's where the manager or the leader is the most senior or experienced person in the room. And therefore, they're also the person who calls the shots. And so there's this dynamic of leadership as a form of influence, because I think all leadership does ultimately come down to influence, but that influence is really influence through decree. So do it because I say so. Now, that might still have a very benevolent and friendly tone about it, but the dynamic is very much of I'm the boss, do as I say. And it's born out of a very traditional way of working, but also a traditional kind of way in which the workplace does flow. Whereas I think more than ever, there is a need for leaders to have quite a different approach, and that is where their influence on which their entire leadership is based, that influence is not through decree but comes more through what I like to describe as win me. So this shift from decree to win me is more about, hey, I want to create teams, I want to create workplaces, I want to create a group of colleagues and employees or whoever is around me, could be in a community group, who are engaged in the work that they do, not simply because it's a job and not simply because it's what we've decreed is the way we're going, but because they want to do it that way. They choose to follow the initiatives, the projects, the strategies, the directions that we create. And I think once you do that, a couple of things happen. One is you tap an enormous stream of potential in terms of people's ability to do more, to do it more enthusiastically, to do it more creatively, to do it with greater flair, speed, and all sorts of things. But I think the other thing you do is you fill a very important human need, which is more than ever, I think, the modern workforce is saying, hey, I want my workplace to be an extension of the way I like to live my life as well, where I have autonomy, I have a sense of discretion, I have real contribution and meaning in the work that I do. I think once you kind of tap those two things, you start to really kind of create a workplace or an organization that's able to achieve a whole lot more.
I agree with that. I agree with lots of what you just said, and the fact that people want to have their work experience be a lived experience that is resonant from the core of who they are. And I love how you mentioned that the ability to contribute and be part of something meaningful is a critical part of doing that. And I think also with that is a need and a desire for a sense of belonging. And I'm wondering, in terms of developing buy-in and collaboration, how much is a sense of belonging a part of what you think is important in a collaborative place?
Oh, that's a lovely question. I think a huge element of it. I think, you know, our need to be, you know, again, if I go back to that traditional model of work, which is I'm an employee who comes in and provides my service, whatever that might be, and I do that from 9 to 5 and then I go home, and really that's for the paycheck so that I can feed my family. I think for a lot of people, they're looking for a whole lot more out of work, and they're looking for a place that they can feel they can be part of and want to be part of, feel that they can identify with and talk about with their friends and their family and say, hey, this is where I work and I'm really proud about that. And you see it with organisations that struggle in some way or, you know, make a false step in some way, and that happens in the public eye. People who work in those organisations really struggle with the sense of, oh, gosh, what am I part of here? What do I belong to here? What do I identify with or not? So I think, yeah, we are creating little communities, tribes, call them what you will, where people bring their whole selves to work. And, of course, the other thing about that is that for a lot of industries, work is just no longer defined by 9 to 5 or whatever hours we traditionally did define it by. There's much more this focus on, you know, being able to work flexibly, and that might mean working a little bit in the office, a little bit at home, and the hours in which I do that might be fluid and improvised from week to week. So again, if I'm being asked to bring myself in and out of the workplace like that and do so to the fullest potential, I kind of need to feel like it's somewhere I want to be.
Yeah, otherwise it's a long sense of drudgery day to day, for sure. So I'm curious, though, because you talk a lot about buy-in, you know, and in fact, the subtitle of your book is How to Get People to Buy Into Your Ideas. And I hear this a lot from clients who say, you know, how can I manage up, or how can I get people to come along for the ride, or to get behind this idea? And that's like a little bit different than talking about a nice collaborative. It sounds like to me anyway, it sounds like a little bit different than this is a nice collaborative environment. We all pitch in, we all get along, and it's, you know, tiptoe through the tulips. So I'm interested about this idea of buy-in. What does that mean to you, and what do people struggle with around buy-in?
You know, the danger with all of these sorts of words, whether it's collaboration or buy-in, is that people form a skeptical view of it as well based on their own experiences. Like I had someone not that long ago, say to me, oh, buy-in, that just sounds like a management technique to get people to do more.
Yeah.
And I guess, truth be told, it could be seen that way because it could be experienced that way because it could be done that way. But when I wrote this book, it definitely was not through that as a lens. It was through the notion of, I think there is an awful lot that can be achieved if you create teams of people who aren't simply doing what they're told to do because they think they have to, or because that's the easiest way to operate, but because they choose to, they truly sign in. So I think when I think of buy-in, I think of it as being it's the emotional sign-up. Mm. It's the part of me that says I buy in. At least there's an emotional investment on my part because I feel connected to what we have agreed to do, the direction we're taking, or whatever it might be. And because of that, I push myself a little bit harder. I bring more of my creative energies to the table. Mm. I actually care about the outcome of this project or this idea, and so therefore I'm going to find ways to prioritize it or fight for time or fight for resources. I'm going to have to get a bit more creative about it because it's something I want to see happen. And probably most importantly, I start to become a leader myself. You know, I don't want to again sound trite about that, but I think, you know, someone who buys in becomes, I use this term, a catalyst. They become someone who is not just walking around like a courier of a project or a message, but they're actually seeking to get others on board themselves. And so you create this much more dispersed form of leadership amongst teams, which I think is really critical. So I think that's the notion of buy-in, is to create a group of people who feel a sense of ownership in an idea at an emotional level, and that fuels their action. The second part of your question, I think, was what then gets in the way of that?
Yeah.
I think the real thing that gets in the way of it more than anything is just, to go back to your earlier points, is, you know, the traditional form of leadership and management. And I think in particular there, a couple of things happen. One is that people who are initiating ideas or projects or strategies, so think of somebody who's typically in that kind of leadership or management role. One of the biggest challenges I find in working with leaders is that they struggle to simply slow down enough or to let go enough to let other people in to an idea.
That's interesting. Tell me more about that.
Well, I think there's a paradox here that in order to influence and shape direction in a way that creates buy-in, you actually need to let go of control in order to gain some control. So now if I give you an example of a group that I was working with recently, was a leadership team in a fairly large organisation, and they were developing strategy for the next 3 years. And at the end of it, the question was, well, how do we ensure that we get our next layer of management on board with this? And one of the people in the room said, oh, well, we've got a comms strategy around that, and we'll get our comms team onto it, comms being short for communications. And I had to challenge them at that point and say, what do you mean your comms team will take care of it? They said, well, we've got clear now idea of what we want to do. We just need the comms team to articulate that and cascade the message down. And I think the instant reaction for me in that is, well, it's one thing to communicate a message, to cascade it down, which is such a fabulous cliche you hear used a lot. But it's a different thing entirely to do so in a way that enables you to think, hey, has that next group of management in our organisation bought into this? Have they emotionally connected with it in some way? And to get to that point is probably not going to be as efficient as simply rolling out a communication strategy. In other words, you're going to have to slow down, invite them into conversation, embrace some concerns, discuss, have some dialogue about it. And to do that requires a bit of patience, but also, I'd say in leaders, a fair bit of vulnerability, willingness to open their ideas up for scrutiny and discussion and to not be too defensive about it.
I think that's the hardest part, because it's so much easier just to rest on authority and say, this is it, we've worked it out, off we go, it's a good idea, can't you tell, rah, rah, let's bulldoze on through. And I think you're right, it's not as efficient, perhaps, to do a collaborative approach where you sit down and you discuss and you invite and you let it evolve with the contribution of your people. And yet, it's way more effective if you do that instead of, as you say, lead by decree. So one of the things you mentioned in your book, did you want to add anything to that?
Look, I was just going to say, and I want to be really clear, I'm not just sort of painting a picture here that somehow people in management roles or positions of authority are just trying to kind of fulfill some image in their head of being Alexander the Great here. It's not, I don't think it's a fight for power all the time. I think it's, you know, also sometimes a function of, well, I've got an awful lot I need to achieve. There's a lot resting on my shoulders, the things that I'm charged with. And I might have my own stakeholders, whether it's a CEO or whether it's a board of directors or an owner of the business or shareholders or whoever, they're all looking at me and saying, what are the results? So I feel that sense of I need to get stuff done, and I need to get it done quickly, and there's a lot to do. So therefore, it sometimes seems like the most efficient route to simply punch through one idea or initiative or project after another. But of course, the cost of doing so without getting people to that place of buy-in and that place where they own it is that these ideas might get launched, but they may not get very far. They might hit all kinds of resistance, they might stall, they might run out of support and energy, or they may just never get off the ground.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to clarify that perception, because I think that's the complexity of this.
Yeah, it's not as black and white as I would make it out to be, that's for sure. And that sort of points me to one of the questions I want to ask you around language. One of the things you mentioned in your book is how important mood and language is to creating this atmosphere where collaboration thrives. Tell me a little bit more about that. What do you mean specifically with mood, and how do you create mood? And what is it about language that we need to be mindful of?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think the mood you create around an idea is instrumental to how people feel about it, and therefore, you know, the heart, I often say the heart, it's the heart that determines what the head's going to focus on. And, you know, the heart's taking all kinds of cues unconsciously around how to feel about something. Now, that might be as simple as, you know, your question's focused on language. That might be as simple as an organisation using or, you know, leaders using language that feels easy and familiar, but it becomes just jargon or management speak or cliched or hollow. You know, I think it's a lovely term, weasel words as well. But, you know, a CEO who stands at the front of the room and says, oh, you know, I want to talk about cascading a strategy that's going to take us forward into the future. These are all terms that probably sound like the cliche of leadership speak, but they're likely to feel an audience feeling at best cold and at worst deeply skeptical of what they're hearing. You know, I've heard it all before. So I think, you know, at the first instance, you know, there's this wonderful focus by various now leadership authors around the importance of just speaking plain and speaking real. And I think that's a critical piece in this. I think the other thing with language and mood is I think it's up to leaders to try and find a way to bring their ideas to life for people at an emotional level, not just an intellectual level. So I think in some respects, sometimes in the corporate world in particular and government as well, you know, there's almost like a race to try and rationalize ideas till they are, you know, as succinctly and smartly put as possible. And so as a result, we just still things down to it's your business case, your return on investment, your ROI, of course, or your graphs and your pie charts and all the rest of it, things that, again, are kind of the familiar tools of, you know, the business analyst or the MBA. But what about the age-old art of telling a great story that really highlights people's understanding of the situation, a story that is vulnerable enough where a leader can say, hey, let me tell you about my own experiences over the last 3 years in dealing with some of our customers and some of the conversations we've had. And, you know, I was sitting down having a fantastic conversation with one of our longest-standing customers who had really expressed some disappointment around one of our products. And we were sitting there and talking about the product, and I just looked at them and I thought, you understand this business better than I do. And as I sat there in that conversation and I was thinking about that, I thought to myself, if this customer understands our business better than I do, then how many of our other customers understand things we just don't? And it was at that moment I realized, you know, that's something that I think we should all be engaging with, is trying to tap this huge pool of knowledge and understanding and experience that our customers have that we don't. Now, I think, I'm just improvising that story, but I think stories like that are a much more powerful way to get an audience to sit up and pay attention at first than to simply hit them with pools of data and information. So I think that's a critical piece in this as well.
I love that as a very useful, practical, and almost blindly obvious point, is to ask the people who are your end users, your customers, the people for whom you exist. And it reminds me, I saw an American speaker, his name's John Spence. He spoke at the Big Idea Conference in Toowoomba last week. And he was talking about what are the critical, finding out in your business, what are the critical key customer touch points in your business. You know, what are the things that are like, if you don't get these right, you've lost business. So for a restaurant was the example, you need to have great food, great service, clean bathrooms, as an example. And if you get bad food or bad service or bad bathrooms, particularly bad bathrooms, forget it. You're never going back there. And so my question to him was, well, how can you figure out the key touch points in your own business? Because we're often blind to that. And he said to me, you just ask your customers. And I love that, because that's your point exactly, is let's actually talk to people, have heart-to-heart conversations about what's most important, and to elicit the stories through real-life experience is the way to win hearts. So I think that's a fabulous suggestion. In fact, the narrative that's coming through in our conversation so far is to be really real with people, is to drop the jargon and drop the rush and just show up and be mana a mana, or human to human, with each other, which is a lovely message.
It is. And, you know, I think we're at a point in time where, you know, there's all sorts of interesting bits of research coming through about this at the moment, but we're at a point in time where our trust in leaders is at an all-time low. And it's because I think we are more skeptical than ever about the rehearsed company line, if you like, or the rehearsed message. And we see it with our politicians who, you know, use expressions and language and slogans over and over again as if we are somehow going to be duped by that. But we, I guess we see through it. We go, I know that you're somewhere in there behind that message, and I want to know where you are. And so our, you know, we kind of have to let go of neat and tidy language and just be prepared to be vulnerable enough again to use kind of simple language that expresses what we're feeling ourselves. You know, I had this, I'm staying in a hotel at the moment. I'm calling you from a hotel. I won't say which one or where, so I don't, you know, drop them in it, but there's some building works going on here at the moment, and it's been, you know, horrendously noisy. And I was terrified that it was going to be, you know, I'd have, you know, a huge pneumatic drill popping through the wall as we were trying to do this interview. So I was speaking with the manager down, well, first the poor bloke on reception, and then the manager after that, trying to get some kind of resolution. But in the three layers of conversation I had, I just literally heard the same message or line being recited to me time after time, around, you know, it's the policy of our hotel to make sure that our customers are well cared for. However, there are limitations to that, as we only have a fixed number of rooms. Now, there was nothing untruthful about that, what they were saying, but it was the veneer of, again, communications management that deeply irritated me and interrupted the connection between us. Just don't do it. Just talk plain. Oh, I'm so sorry. This is really difficult for us. You don't have to have a solution. Just talk real.
I think some of that is lack of experience too. Like, I don't know if they were younger staff or whether they've just been institutionalized through their work effort. I had a lunch in Brisbane last week, and I went there 10 minutes before the lunch because I was hosting it to make sure everything was all sorted, and 10 to 12. And I went in to go get seated, and she's like, I'm sorry, we only let people in at 12 p.m. That's when we are between services right now. And I was like, I'm like, right. Are you kidding me? Can I not just come in and sit down at my table? I don't care if you're still putting the knives and forks out. But it was just like this blanket, go away, thou shall not pass kind of experience. And looking at this young, she was a young lady, she clearly was following the rules. And I'm wondering if it's sometimes it's just lack of experience, or whether it's just been hammered into us to follow the rules. And that gets in the way of us actually connecting authentically with people around us. What do you think around that?
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to add to that, and I think if you go down a layer again, and this is why it's particularly important for any leader, I don't think it has to be a lack of experience, but I think the issue that sits at the core of it is fear. Fear that I will lose control, or I will lose power, or I will lose influence. And, you know, that's why I often talk about how important courage is in leadership generally, but these kinds of conversations, because I have to have the courage to be open to other people's point of view and to spend time listening to them without allowing myself to be governed by the fear that I'll lose control by listening, or that I will lose control and influence if I allow some of their ideas into the mix, or if I allow the possibility that when they say no, and when they say, oh, that's not going to work, that I allow the possibility that there might be something truthful in that to them. Because the moment I allow that, I allow also the possibility that my entire idea and my entire proposition is going to come crashing down around us. And so out of fear, I think we often try and shore up everything that we're thinking and everything we have to say. And that stifles the real conversation again.
So I'm wondering if this style approach works better in private sector than public service. And you might have some experience with that. And the reason I ask that is because I'm thinking about how some of my public service clients really are on the receiving end of a dictum. And I'm trying to imagine them trying to build a sense of collaboration and collegiality in an environment where they are told this is happening and they really don't have any recourse to make it any different. What's your experience with that? Do you work much in the public service versus private sector and see how people respond to change that's mandated like that?
Look, the majority of my work is private sector, but it's a very live, the question you asked is very live for me right now because I've got one pretty large public sector client that is grappling with that question right now. And there is a constraint, as you say, within the system in that, you know, there is very much this hand down of policy or of priority or direction, and that can change on a day-to-day basis. And it's coming from people who feel like they sit outside their immediate systems, for the minister or whoever it might be. But what I do kind of still think is that even if you acknowledge that constraint for a sec, and I think you have to, there's then the question of, well, how do we as a department, for example, overall, or as a public agency overall, how do we manage and cope with those demands? How do we deliver against them in a way that is clever, efficient, and effective, so we actually deliver on the results? And how do we do it in a way that makes the experience of doing work a positive one? You know, so there's a live question, for example, with one group I'm working with, which is how do we, you know, given that there's so many priorities coming down the pipeline and we're not getting quite as many resources as we thought we would to be able to deliver against those, how do we cope? And the answer is staring them in the face, which is we're going to have to get better at sharing across this very large agency. How do we share resources, information, knowledge? How do we cooperate? How do we streamline? There's no way we're going to be able to do that unless we change things, both in terms of our leadership mindset, and secondly, make some changes in terms of systems. And I think you have to think of both of those in this, particularly institutions like that.
It's a tough gig, that's for sure. So I like that you give us a little ray of hope with that, though, even though that many organizations are on the top-down receiving end of orders and priorities, et cetera, as you say, that we can actually respond in a collaborative way. I think that's a useful tip, that's for sure. And one thing
I was going to say, I once read someone was writing about their experience of working at Apple, and they said during the tenure of Steve Jobs, there was an enormous amount of pressure and demand in terms of the amount that the organization would do and the priorities that would come through, and sometimes they would change direction quite dramatically. And they said there was an enormous amount, as a result of that, an enormous amount of collaborative spirit throughout the organization in terms of how do we best cope and adjust with that. And I thought that was interesting because it's almost like the same issue, but in a private sector context.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a good analogy. Respond in the collaborative spirit. It's like, right, those are the winds of, it's almost like being on a ship at sea and you might have one plan, but all of a sudden the wind changes and everybody, it's all hands on deck to get the ship rigged in a different direction to cope with the new forces at play. And so even though you have no control over the weather, you do have control over how you run your ship and respond to the prevailing headwinds. So I like that, the whole collaborative spirit.
Nice.
In spite of things that are out of control. I'm dying to ask you about this. You talk about Nemawashi. I don't even know if that's pronounced correctly in your book. What is that and what's important about that?
Yeah, Nemawashi. Yeah, no, it's spot on. Says he who has no deep expertise in speaking Japanese at all, because Nemawashi is a Japanese term. And I love the idea of Nemawashi. So it's not just a Japanese word. It's actually a core cultural concept within Japan. And if you take the word Nemawashi, it literally translates as preparing the roots for transplant. So if you can imagine it being applied for a second to a bonsai plant, and you're about to move the bonsai plant from one pot to another, to repot it. And the idea of an emawashi is that you would first of all spend time before you can transplant that plant successfully without it dying, healing over 6 weeks later. You actually need to take time first to prepare the roots themselves, whether that's a combination of fertilizing them, trimming them, whatever it might be, to make sure the plant is ready to be shifted. It applies that idea in Japanese culture. You apply that idea now to the whole act of getting your ideas across the line, to doing business in groups. And so now the idea of nemawashi is, and the Japanese, you know, what I love here is they'll literally use the term. They'll ask, have you done nemawashi on this idea first? So the idea here is now, if I've got a presentation I want to do to an executive management group, and there's eight of them in that room, the idea that I would walk into that room and present that idea to them in that room for the first time with all of eight of them sitting there and then ask them to give me their approval there and then is just cultural suicide. You just don't do it.
Right.
So the notion is you've got to prepare the roots for transplant. So you've got to spend time in the corridors or in private conversations first, gently teasing out and, you know, here in Australia, the word socialising, the idea has sort of started to take root a little bit. So socialising the idea, spreading it, talking about it with my stakeholders and saying, here's what I've got in mind. I'd love to get your view on this. And I suppose there's two things about that. One is there's a respect piece kicking in there, which is I don't walk into a group of senior people and ask them to commit their position on something in front of their colleagues, because that makes it very hard for them to save face if their answer is no or if it's different from their colleagues. And the second is that it respects their input. So over the period of consulting and getting their ideas on board, it gives me the opportunity to shape up my idea in a way that is fundamentally yesable. So it's an idea that I know is going to fly with this group. So it's a delicate art of consultation, and it's actually been embodied into the Toyota way. So Toyota being a classic, you know, Japanese company, the Toyota way embodies nemawashi as one of its operating principles as well. So it's a great idea, and I think there's an enormous amount. It's unique to Japan as a concept, but there's an enormous amount for us to learn about it in terms of this whole idea of going slow in order to go fast, and you want to get your ideas across the line.
I love that. So, yeah, it's similar to the idea of you have the meetings before the meeting. In terms of go around and you canvas opinions and not necessarily doing a sales job, which is a one-way traffic kind of approach to leadership and engagement, but more as you discuss it, as an invitation for conversation and perspective. I think that's great, nemawashi. So I have one last question, and it centers around this whole idea of ideas. And when it comes to buy-in and influence, can a good idea be enough on its own to get buy-in?
That echoes of if a tree falls in the wood and no one's there to hear it, doesn't make a sound. It's a profound question, because I guess in theory I would have to say yes. In practice I'd have to say, is an idea ever on its own? I mean, is it ever not filtered? Of course, if we're sitting in a room by ourselves and we have an idea, then you might say that's the purest form of an idea, and so that's why we buy into it. But the moment, you know, we want to get an idea across the line, we need to get it through all kinds of filters, perception filters that might come about because of the relationship. Now, how you feel about me is going to create necessary bias to yes or to no. So a bias, you know, if you trust me and you think I'm onto a winning thing all the time, then obviously you're going to have a bias to yes when I come to the table with a new idea. But I think you would have to say, I mean, if you take out all those filters for a second, you would have to say that the quality of the idea in the first instance is going to be a critical part of buy-in. Otherwise, the risk is that, you know, we focus on all of these other aspects of the buy-in process, i.e. the way you message it, the relationship, the mood, the way you provide people with the scaffolding and the structure to actually take that idea and turn it into action. If we focus on all of those things alone, then I think that is where we risk starting to see buy-in as purely a matter of kind of perception management.
Mm.
And I think at the nucleus, now, if I'm going to think of buy-in as a truly, as a genuine exercise, I think it has to assume that the merit of the idea in and of itself is the thing that gives this a positive ethic from beginning to end. So, yes, I'm trying to shape your perception of it, but that's because I believe that if you were able to view it independently, this idea would be one that you would want to say yes to, that this idea is one that meets your needs, adds value for you, that your concerns can be overcome, and I'm not trying to hoodwink you past all of that. So I think at its purest form, the idea is where it's at.
Wow, I love that. It makes so much sense to me now to think about why ideas have their day or don't have their day, and it's not just the pure idea. It's all those other messy, complex interactions that you described that can bring it to life or not. So there is quite a lot to attend to when you're trying to evoke change or a mission or a vision or a project that you are passionate about, and that it's not just going in with this all guns blazing with I have the solution. There is a lot more to it in terms of engagement and co-creating, which is the essence of your book, which is a fabulous book. And I'm going to put a link to that. A link to your site and website and to the book on the podcast page, which is at zoeralph.com/podcast/Simon. And you'll get to see all of Simon's work there. Is there any last message you want to leave to our listeners?
Oh.
There you go.
other than that, your podcast is fabulous, which I've listened to before, but then they should already know that. Look, I think the real juice of collaboration and buy-in comes from people simply being able to step into a place of what's possible. I use this expression, what's possible, all the time. And I think, again, you know, what I'm always encouraging people to do is to let go a little bit of that need to drive an outcome too quickly because it's efficient to do it or it seems easier to do it, and to step back and be inclusive enough in their thinking to say, oh, I wonder what's possible in this conversation. To be abundant enough to think that actually by having a conversation with others around their ideas, that when we put our two heads together, we might actually come up with something better than my original proposition. And for that reason, to be courageous enough to actually sit in that possibility of not knowing for however brief it might be, to explore those possibilities. And I reckon that's, to go back to your first question to me about the lawyering and improv world,
yeah,
that's probably the most valuable thing I've got out of improv, and it's why it's a through line in everything I do, and I keep improvising, is because it forces you to let go. You can't barrel on stage and have a script that you want to roll out. You have to let go and be open to, I wonder what's possible as we all step onto this stage in front of this paying audience. And if we could live our lives a little bit like that, I think we'd get, yeah, we get better results, and people just feel like they're having a lot more fun doing it.
What a great message. And I think what folks don't know underneath, if they're just listening to you for the first time, is that this whole spirit of what's possible and having an abundant mindset comes from your, I don't know if it's your natural tendency, but certainly your lived tendency to simply show up and appreciate the moment. And I've read a lot of what you've written about your simple observations of the day and just being present to what is. And remember this one description you had in one forum where you talked about appreciating a piece of salmon that you cooked for the evening. And the simple joy you took in cooking a piece of salmon was just so delightful. And I think, Simon, that is one of your true gifts, is that you bring to your life and to your work and to people around you, is your ability to show up and just be delighted in what is in the moment. And I think if we could all adopt some of that, we'd all be better off as people and as leaders. So thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and insight. It's always a joy to spend time with you, Simon.
My absolute pleasure. The treat was all mine. Thank you, Zoe.